Today is Friday, May 21st, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington. These are some of the stories we are covering for you this morning. Israel and the Palestinian militant group Hamas have agreed to a ceasefire after more than a week of conflict left hundreds dead. The United Nations General Assembly gathered at the UN headquarters to debate the conflict between Israel and Hamas in Gaza.
So there was a lot of rhetoric. 12 foreign ministers flew in from Arab and Muslim countries. This is the first time in more than 14 months there's been a meeting at this level inside the UN headquarters because of the COVID pandemic.
And the head of the World Trade Organization says waiving intellectual property rights for COVID-19 vaccines will not be enough to narrow the huge supply gap between rich and poor countries. We'll have those stories and more coming up right here on International Edition. Our top story today, Israel and the Palestinian militant group Hamas have agreed to a ceasefire after more than a week of conflict left hundreds dead. Israel media reported on Thursday that Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's security cabinet had approved the truce on the basis of what one official was quoted as calling, quote, quiet in exchange for quiet. Reporter Linda Gradstein has been covering the conflict and joins me for more on this story.
Well, they've just announced that starting early Friday, there will be a ceasefire between Israel and Hamas in Gaza. Confirmation has come from both sides, from both the Israeli side and from Hamas. Hamas says that there are certain conditions that Israel agreed to meet on Jerusalem. Israel says that it is an unconditional ceasefire. And so it's not clear if there really are conditions or if there are some sort of understandings. But what does seem to be clear is that after 11 days of conflict, the worst conflict since 2014, that there will be a ceasefire. Usually what's happened in the past before a ceasefire is you have kind of last barrages of rockets from Hamas to show that they still have some rockets left. A Hamas official said, we have plenty of rockets. We're going for the ceasefire because we think it's the best decision for Hamas. Israel says that Hamas has suffered a very serious blow and that there will be a new deterrence and that Hamas has lost a lot of its power.
Now, yesterday it was reported that Prime Minister Netanyahu had rebuffed President Biden's calls for a ceasefire. What likely happened in the last 24 hours that led to this cessation in hostilities?
Well, I think there was a decision on the Israeli side that they couldn't continue this operation indefinitely, that public opinion was starting to build against Israel, both because of the numbers of civilians killed. Israel says it does everything it can to avoid civilian casualties, but Gaza is such a densely populated area that if you're doing airstrikes on Gaza, you're going to have civilian casualties. And I think there was a decision on the Israeli side that they had sort of achieved what they had hoped to achieve, that Hamas has now been hit very hard. Dozens of Hamas fighters have been killed. A lot of the Hamas tunnels that they had used for smuggling have been hit, and that continuing the fighting wouldn't really get any gains for Israel. And I think on the Hamas side, you know, they can go out saying they still have missiles to fire, you know, they can also call it a victory. So you got to a situation of growing international pressure and a way for both sides to kind of climb down from the tree and get back to the sort of ceasefire that has held on and off for the past 7 years.
Now, I think it was a week ago when Israel bombed the building that housed Associated Press and other media organizations. How did this affect the coverage of the conflict?
Well, I think, you know, Israel says that that building was being used by Hamas as well, and has Israel says they in fact showed proof to the American government that it was being used by Hamas. Israel also says that it gave a warning to evacuate that building so that, you know, you didn't have a situation where a lot of journalists were killed or wounded. And Israel has all along said that if they find Hamas using a civilian building or a hospital or anything else, that they will consider that a target. That said, I think it did cause a lot of bad international press for Israel, and I think it probably was part of the pressure on Israel to stop the operation.
But did that create a disruption in the coverage?
I don't think it created a disruption in the coverage. I mean, you know, the coverage continued both from Gaza and from Israel. There, you know, what happened, I think, in the immediate aftermath is just that the AP office in Jerusalem took up the coverage while kind of the journalists in Gaza, you know, but the journalists in Gaza, you know, with the way that the world works today, you know, you have with cell phones and with technology that they continue to film. I mean, the filming of that building being hit was all over social media within minutes after it happened.
Now, it has been announced that Egypt is going to monitor the ceasefire. What has been the role of Egypt in the past conflicts? Is it viewed as a neutral arbitrator in this region as regards to this issue?
Well, Egypt does have a peace treaty with Israel. It is, however, a cold peace. That said, there are a lot of security ties between Israel and Egypt. And at the same time, Egypt has a close relationship with Hamas. Hamas is an offshoot of the Muslim Brotherhood, which is a political party in Egypt. So I think that both sides would see Egypt as a sort of neutral power. And in the past, Egypt has been very active in negotiating with both sides. Israel won't negotiate directly with Hamas. Israel and the U.S. consider Hamas a terrorist organization. So a lot of the negotiations in the past have gone through Egypt.
That was reporter Linda Gradstein. Meanwhile, the United Nations General Assembly gathered at the UN headquarters to debate the conflict between Israel and Hamas in Gaza. VOA United Nations correspondent Margaret Bashir was there and spoke with my colleague Kate Pound-Dawson about the session.
So basically, the object of the organizers of the meeting today, which is the Arab countries and the Muslim countries at the UN, was to basically show the world that Israel is pretty much isolated on the issue of the fighting now going on between them and Hamas in Israel and Palestine. So there was a lot of rhetoric. 12 foreign ministers flew in from Arab and Muslim countries. This is the first time in more than 14 months there's been a meeting at this level inside the UN headquarters because of the COVID pandemic. There was no UN General Assembly last year. Nothing. Everything has been online. But today there was a large presence here at the UN, and the foreign minister of Palestine said, look, this shows you how important this issue is on the global agenda, that people dropped what they were doing and they came here for the first time in 14 months. So there was a lot of scolding of the UN Security Council because they have not been able to speak in a unified way to condemn the violence or to call for a halt to the fighting. That's primarily because the United States has been blocking the other 14 members. They need to have a unanimous agreement to put out some sort of a statement, not a resolution, but a statement, you know, and these kinds of statements must be agreed by all 15. And the U.S. has been trying to get members to hold off saying something, saying they felt it really wasn't helpful to the diplomacy that was going on behind the scenes.
Is there any likelihood that members are going to push forward to endorse any action?
So the General Assembly is more a moral body. It's where all 193 member states gather. Their resolutions are not legally binding like the Security Council's, but they have this moral authority that when a majority of countries say something, everybody should listen. There's no resolution today because there was no time really to negotiate one, to write one. These sorts of things take collaboration among states. So basically, it was just more a debate. But while they were here, we did hear news that there is a ceasefire that should be going into force at 2 a.m. a local time in Israel and Palestine on Friday.
Now, the news of a ceasefire, is that likely to change the tone of the discussion or any actions there at the UN?
Well, I think now it's a wait and see period. We have to see if the ceasefire goes into effect at 2 a.m., if it stays in effect, if the rockets stop being fired from Gaza, if the airstrikes stop happening from the Israeli side, if the deaths stop happening and the destruction. That's really what everybody wants. And then the next step really is to try and revitalize the stalled peace process between Israel and Palestine, because at the end of the day, we're just going to keep having these sorts of every few year flare-ups because there's no resolution of the root cause of the problem. And that's the fact that after 70 years, there's still no peace between Israel and the Palestinians.
That was Margaret Bashir, the VOA United Nations correspondent. She was speaking with International Edition's Kate Pound Dawson. May 25th will mark 1 year since a white police officer in Minneapolis killed George Floyd, a black man. The resulting widespread U.S. protests against police brutality and systemic racism have had reverberations across industries and the U.S. government. VOA correspondent Mariama Diaro reports.
After George Floyd was killed last year in police custody, protests exploded in America's streets. Reaction also extended to corporate boardrooms. To show solidarity, some of America's biggest companies donated millions to support racial justice causes. Justin Hansford teaches law at Howard University in Washington, where he also heads the Thurgood Marshall Civil Rights Center.
I did see there being a rush of real financial contributions coming from corporate America, moving to HBCUs, contributions to social justice organizations, Black Lives Matter. They raised tens of millions of dollars, much more than they've raised in the past 7 years.
In sports, the commissioner of American professional football apologized to players for not listening to their concerns about racism sooner, committing $250 million to tackle the issue over the next decade.
The murder of George Floyd is tragic, painful, and unacceptable.
Big box retailer Walmart pledged to donate $100 million over 5 years to fight systemic racism. Soft drink conglomerate PepsiCo, meanwhile, retired the 132-year-old Aunt Jemima Pancake Mix and Syrup brand, whose logo featured an image of a black woman. The U.S. company said it recognized the character's origins were based on a racial stereotype. It also committed to a 5-year, $400 million initiative to lift up black communities. Despite such actions, America still has healing to do, according to Robert Sanders of the Henry C. Lee College of Criminal Justice and Forensic Sciences at the University of New Haven.
One of the things that is tough for the African-American community and those who empathize with us is there hasn't been any time to heal. So from one monstrous event, as you begin the stages of grief and healing and all of those things, we roll right into another one.
The conviction last month of former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin was a watershed moment, according to Hansford.
Many of us have gone generations without ever expecting to see a police officer convicted for killing a black man. I was thinking about the Rodney King trial, the Trayvon Martin trial. I expected the same outcome. The different outcome to me has a lot to do with the fact that the protests raised awareness in the minds of the jury to the point where they were more knowledgeable about the realities of whether or not a police officer is 100% right 100% of the time.
There must be a reckoning for other police officers who were present when Floyd died, Sanders says.
There are three other perpetrators who, in some ways, you could look at their illegal activity as even more horrifying, as aiding, abetting the murder that they saw in front of their own eyes as their fellow citizens pleaded for them to get engaged and to stop it.
Those officers are awaiting trial. Meanwhile, U.S. Attorney General Merrick Garland recently opened sweeping probes of police departments in two U.S. cities, including the one where Floyd died.
They're looking at the facts of what's going on in our nation and in our policing. And I'm hopeful that, you know, going into and launching a civil probe of policing in Minneapolis and a civil probe of policing in Metro Louisville, where Breonna Taylor was killed, is a start. They are not solutions, but they're a start on a path toward finding a solution, at least in the justice system.
Democrats in the House of Representatives passed the George Floyd Justice in Policing Act. The bill would limit the qualified immunity police officers have against civil suits and create a national registry of police misconduct. The legislation faces hurdles in the Senate, where Republican Tim Scott has introduced his own police reform bill and is in negotiations with Democrats in the evenly divided chamber. Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Washington.
And oral arguments are scheduled today in the case of three former Minneapolis police officers charged in the George Floyd death. AP correspondent Mike Hampen reports.
The Minnesota Court of Appeals will hear arguments on whether the former officers should face an additional count of aiding and abetting third-degree murder. Thomas Lane, Jay King, and Tu Tao are scheduled to go on trial in March on charges of aiding and abetting second-degree murder and manslaughter. Prosecutors wanted to add the third charge following an appeals court ruling in February. The three-judge panel has 90 days to make a ruling. It's possible the judges could rule in favor of the state and send the case back to the lower court to add the charge. I'm Mike Hempen.
Experts are predicting a busy Atlantic storm season, but not as bad as in 2020. Jennifer King from AP reports.
The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration is forecasting that the 2021 Atlantic hurricane season will be busier than normal. Forecasters expect 13 to 20 named storms, with up to 10 of those becoming hurricanes, and 3 to 5 major hurricanes, with winds of more than 110 miles an hour. Lead forecaster Matt Rosenkrantz points to warmer water, reduced crosswinds, stormy weather coming off of Africa, and no El Nino weather event, which would typically squelch Atlantic hurricane activity. In 2020, there were 30 named storms, so many that meteorologists started naming them after letters in the Greek alphabet. Jennifer King, Washington.
The World Health Organization warns that delays in the delivery of COVID-19 vaccines to countries in Africa are putting lives at risk and threatening the continued spread of the coronavirus on the continent and across borders. To date, the WHO reports 4.7 million COVID-19 cases across Africa, including 127,000 deaths. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Shipments of COVID-19 vaccine to Africa slowed to a trickle earlier this month. Its main supplier, India's Serum Institute, retained the doses to tackle a devastating surge of domestic cases. That has essentially brought the rollout of the life-saving product across Africa to a screeching halt. So far, the WHO says only 24 million people in a continent of more than 1 billion have received at least one vaccine dose, and 5.5 million have received two doses. WHO Regional Director for Africa, Machidiso Moeti, deplores the inequities that exist between countries that have access to COVID-19 vaccine and those who do not. In Africa, she says fewer than 2 in 100 people, or 2%, have received one vaccine dose, compared to more than 8 out of 10 people, or 80%, in some high-income countries.
This means that as people living in richer countries can hit the reset button this summer, and their lives will return to a semblance of normal, in Africa, our lives will continue to be on hold. We can still catch up and make up for the lost ground, but time is running out.
Moeti says Africa is also suffering from a severe shortage of money to pay for the operational costs of the COVID-19 vaccine rollout. She says urgent action and international solidarity is crucial in ensuring Africa can obtain the vaccines it needs and finance the rollout.
We welcome the pledge by the United States this week to share 80 million doses with other countries, with a substantial proportion expected to go through the COVAX, in addition to recent shipments of vaccines from France to Mauritania and pledges by several other high-income countries.
The World Bank estimates every month of delay in the provision of COVID-19 vaccine to Africa could cost the continent close to $14 billion in lost GDP. The financial institution so far has provided $1 billion to help 39 African countries tackle the pandemic. Last fall, its board of directors also approved a $12 billion package to help countries purchase and deploy COVID-19 vaccines. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
A U.S. Space Force defense satellite is launched in space. Plus, China makes it to Mars, and a satellite made of wood is scheduled for launch later this year. VOA's Arash Arabasadi has the week in space.
Aboard this rocket sits a defense satellite for the U.S. Space Force. The U.S.-based company United Launch Alliance this week completed the launch after a 24-hour delay caused by the rocket's liquid oxygen system. The satellite is part of the Space-Based Infrared Geosynchronous Satellite Mission, or SBIRS, to serve as an early warning system for missile attacks. The latest launch is the fifth satellite to join the mission. Also this week, NASA launched the Black Brant 12 suborbital rocket. NASA says the mission looks to help scientists learn more about energy and momentum in regions of space that are magnetically connected. Part of that mission is releasing barium vapor into the sky. The agency says the vapor is harmless to the environment and public health. NASA released this still image of the launch, and the next one is scheduled for May 26th. And China this week released these images of a Chinese rover landing on Mars. The mission is one of exploration, and the rover's name is Zhurong after a Chinese god of fire. China joins the United States and the former Soviet Union as the only countries to have landed on Mars, with the U.S. being the only country to successfully do so more than once. Back on Earth, private spaceflight company SpaceX completed its 15th mission this year aboard a Falcon 9 rocket. It launched another 52 satellites as part of its Starlink global broadband network. Astronomers have said the satellites block their view of anything beyond them. SpaceX says the satellites will bring high-speed internet to underserved communities. Finally this week, if all goes according to plan, the atmosphere will soon have in its orbit the most eco-friendly satellite ever. Designers built the WESA Woodsat from plywood and resin to see how it could withstand space. Woodsat's Yari Makinen says the mission is about research.
This satellite is studying the possibilities and we start studying the behavior of wood in space. It won't be a big business, never, I don't think so, but there will be a niche for these kind of materials as well.
Designers say the satellite could reduce fossil fuel emissions from manufacturing traditional satellites by replacing materials with sustainable wood. It would also reduce the amount of metal space junk orbiting Earth. Woodsat is scheduled for launch later this year. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News.
You're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America.
The United States, China, and Western European governments have announced their intention to retool their automobile industries from cars that burn fossil fuels, gas, and oil to electricity-powered vehicles. Experts said this will help mitigate climate change and prove lucrative for businesses who adopt early to so-called clean energy. But what will that transition mean for Africa and other parts of the developing world that rely on oil and gas to fuel their economies? To find out more about what this change might mean for Africa's oil and mineral sectors and for the continent as a whole, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke to Michael Ross, a professor of political science at the University of California, Los Angeles.
It'll have enormous implications for Africa. There's a number of countries that depend heavily on exports of oil and natural gas to keep their economies going. Nigeria, Angola, Congo Brazzaville, South Sudan, Equatorial Guinea, Chad, and so on. And these countries tend to have oil that is not particularly cheap to extract.
So what does that mean?
What that means is as demand goes down globally for petroleum, places where it's more expensive to take it out of the ground are going to see demand drop much more quickly. And the governments are going to have a lot less money, and it's going to be much harder for them to pay their bills. And they're going to have to find other ways to produce jobs and fund their governments and fund public services.
You've mentioned before that mineral wealth is both a blessing and a curse when it comes to Africa. How might that also be the case when so much of the world changes over to electric vehicles from gas?
Countries that have abundant sources of so-called critical minerals, the minerals that are rising in demand as we move toward electric vehicles, they're going to see a big increase in the demand for what they mine. And that potentially means new investment, jobs, government revenues will potentially give governments the opportunity to provide more services, but also probably fund a lot more corruption and could cause political fortunes in those countries to get worse.
But there'll be lots of job loss along the way for workers in the oil fields and other places in the petroleum industry.
Well, the good thing about the minerals industry is that it tends to employ more people. And so there are going to be more people who directly benefit. And for better or worse, mining happens on land. A lot of oil extraction takes place offshore. So you're going to have both more opportunities for local peoples to benefit from new infrastructure, from jobs, from providing services to companies that are working in these areas, but also more environmental degradation and potentially more land disputes and more human rights abuses. So it's kind of a mixed picture.
You mentioned the DRC as an example.
The Democratic Republic of Congo has a long history of political instability, political repression, and is by and large a country that is not likely to spend the money well. So we should be pretty suspicious about what the larger consequences will be. And it's possible that in countries that have strong governments and where people have some ways of holding their governments accountable might benefit. They might indeed get a larger share of the proceeds. But that's a country-to-country struggle, and often it's an uphill battle for citizens to claw some of these benefits out of their governments and out of the hands of the international companies that are operating there.
Historically, there hasn't been a lot of transparency over how the money that's made from these resources, minerals and oil, et cetera, is spent or where it goes.
Yes, that's right. The whole extractive sector, oil, gas, minerals, timber, is clouded by very high levels of secrecy. People don't have the opportunity to find out who's really benefiting. But when the secrecy is peeled back every once in a while, we see all kinds of sweetheart deals, all kinds of corruption with these contracts. So it's not inevitable, but we need to, I think, start from a position of wariness about the benefits that flow to everyday citizens. And Africa's oil wealth has been the entry point for all kinds of pernicious foreign influences ever since the colonial era. And it's one reason why their resources are as often a curse as a blessing. They're undoubtedly a blessing for the governments and the people in power who can capture a large share of it. But it's much rarer that the people on the ground actually benefit.
Michael Ross, a professor of political science at the University of California in Los Angeles, the head of the World Trade Organization, says waiving intellectual property rights for COVID-19 vaccines will not be enough to narrow the huge supply gap between rich and poor countries. WTO Chief Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala told the European Union on Thursday that a more holistic approach is needed, including the transfer of technology and know-how to allow more vaccine production in Africa and Latin America. Meanwhile, many developed countries rapidly are vaccinating their populations. Most poorer countries are struggling to get vaccines. In the United States, President Joe Biden has supported the idea of patent waivers for the vaccines, but the European Union and some other countries have said doing so would not increase production. Meanwhile, U.S. President Joe Biden on Thursday signed legislation intended to fight anti-Asian hate crimes that surged by 150% last year in the United States during the coronavirus pandemic. Hate and racism are the ugly poison that has long haunted and plagued our nation, the president said before signing the bill in the White House East Room. The law establishes a new Justice Department position to expedite the review of COVID-19-related hate crimes and provide support for local law enforcement agencies to respond to such violence.
It also is intended to improve hate crime data collection and establish telephone hotlines and online reporting of such acts. Before the president spoke, Vice President Kamala Harris, the first Black and Asian American to hold the office, told the audience that the law brings us one step closer to stopping hate, not only for Asian Americans, but for all Americans. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Be sure to visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day at voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a great day.